We're living in a technological tsunami that is being spearheaded by artificial intelligence. It's already everywhere, dispatching goods from warehouses in response to your clicks, identifying your favorite music, accelerating social media likes and dislikes, even replacing jobs. Believe some, and our very humanity is at risk as algorithms written by big tech increasingly run our lives. Governments and the public are on the sidelines. We are mere bystanders of this rapid technological advance. So how should we be feeling about this? How can we tame this revolution to work for societal and economic advantage? Or is it already too late? To tell us is Professor Anthony Elliott, one of the world's top sociologists, who's made it his business to explore this emergent new universe. Professor of Sociology at the University of South Australia, he has just published an influential book mapping this new landscape, Algorithms of Anxiety, Fear in the Digital Age. He covers this topic uniquely as a social scientist and not as a tech bro from inside Silicon Valley. Welcome to the We Society, Anthony.
Thanks very much, Will. Thanks for having me on.
We Society, what was your first reaction when you got the invitation from us to be on a We Society podcast?
I very much like the idea of being on the We Society podcast because I've listened to quite a few of these podcasts and you've had some really influential and interesting discussions along the way. I suppose one of the interesting things in the context of what we're talking about on this episode is that, of course, the great technological tsunami, as I've come to call it, of the artificial intelligence revolution, really, I suppose, throws a bit of a spanner into the works for some aspects of the We Society.
Absolutely. Let's kick off. Just how is this world of integrated machine intelligence, chatbots, predictive algorithms, kind of digital automation, how is it affecting our lives?
I think there's the first thing to say on that is certainly in terms of the extensity of artificial intelligence, it's by which I mean its scale and its scope. I mean, obviously, with something like AI, we all know because it's constantly in the newspapers. You can't turn on a TV program or flick on the radio without hearing some claim about how AI is going to transform our lives today. But in terms of trying to get a handle on its actual scale and scope, there are, I suppose, different ways of doing that. I mean, one way you could do that is simply by looking at the AI hubs. That's pretty easy to do. We know, for example, that they're in Silicon Valley, Boston, London, Beijing, Shenzhen. So that kind of tells us something about the kind of new geopolitics, I suppose, of the world. But part of my argument is that it's not just to do with extensity. It's not just the scale and scope of AI. It's the fact that actually AI goes all the way down. It's the intensity of artificial intelligence as to how it's regrooving our lives today. So by going all the way down, I simply mean that I think it affects increasingly everything, our identities, our friendships, our family life, sexuality, and the body.
Big claims, Anthony, big claims. I mean, let's just kick off with loss of agency and kind of constraints on personal freedom.
Yeah.
I mean, why do you, isn't it enlarging possibilities rather than constraining them?
So certainly, I think the only way to make sense of this technological tsunami, and by the way, in referring to that, I don't just mean AI. I mean, obviously now it's principally AI, but it's got to be seen in the context, I think, of accelerating automation, of advanced robotics, of big data, of machine learning, deep learning, Industry 4.0 and on and on. I mean, this is a technological tsunami from wall to wall. And yes, Will, I mean, these are big claims, but at the same time, there's no doubt that society is increasingly now automating itself through the use of big data and through algorithmic recommendation predictions. We see this across public institutions and a vast array of industries. I mean, we see it in healthcare, in banking, retail, services sector. And you're right. I mean, as these changes sweep through society, AI's taking on a bigger and bigger decision-making role in more areas of our life. And the consequences of this, I think, are just huge.
Yeah.
The game-changing promise to do things like improve efficiency, to bring down costs, to integrate more and more information to aid in strategic decision-making. You know, lots of this is undeniably happening. I suppose one of the things I've been most struck by is all of these opportunities and gains are also offset with significant anxieties today now about the kind of serious flaws in the way that we're using much of this profiling data and the way it's sort of introducing biases and discrimination and various dubious predictions.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people listening to this will be thinking, well, I quite like it when I'm on Spotify. If you like this, then you might like that. Introduce a kind of music you wouldn't otherwise have listened to, or there is Amazon and same-day delivery. So there's lots of ways in which, our lives are improved by this. At the same time, you know, the Patriot Act in the United States in 2001 requires every tech company to provide data to the US government on request. So, for example, in the House of Commons, all our MPs use Microsoft 365. So every single email could be kind of AI trawled by Microsoft on the request of the US government. And that's a menace, which is not really talked about. I mean, how do you pilot your way in your work between these advantages and these menaces?
I suppose one of the ways I've ended up doing that is... It really came out, actually, the spur for this most recent book, Algorithms of Anxiety, came out of some work I did sitting as a member of the Australian Government Review of Artificial Intelligence, where I was hearing more and more evidence as to the kind of these global threats and the different risks that you've just highlighted about AI to the economy, especially, you know, people are increasingly worried about AI robots taking their jobs, and understandably so. I must have sat through, you know, dozens of these extended submissions from economists and policy analysts and industry leaders, each of whom sort of highlighted their growing threat of jobs going to robots. And that made me think that there was this really interesting contrast between much of the sort of hype of AI, these sort of radical promises to instantly transform our lives and in such beneficial ways, on the one hand, against this backdrop of the devastation that it was already starting to threaten to various job sectors. And that contrast, I think, is all too stark. But those issues have been largely discussed, at least I think in policy circles, internally to the sort of discourse of AI itself. So that's to say, you know, policy experts have tried to explain the disruptive side effects of AI only by internal reference to artificial intelligence. So the matter's really been treated as a matter sui generis. And the more I reflected on these various submissions, the more I began to think that actually, I think there's something that cross-cuts all of these risks, that cross-cuts these divisions and these terrible fears and disabling anxieties that are increasingly spawned by AI, because, you know, we could substitute jobs going to robots for really any of the following, like, you know, issues around algorithmic bias or the automation scandals. I mean, in Australia, we've had the robo-debt scandal, you've had the post office scandal, or the massive controversy over AI ethics and governance. So, you know, I think that it's probably some of that work that really prompted me to try to think in a deeper way about, so what's going on at the current juncture, and that why is fear, why are more and more people anxious about the age of AI?
You are saying, though, it's Kafkaesque in the workplace. I mean, it's quite dark, some of your reflections.
Some of the reflections are dark, but I think that probably reflects some of the anxieties. I mean, we're in an age now where people seem to, I mean, there's an endless menu of fears. People are worried about, you know, it's information overload, or social media's harmful effects on teenagers, or people are fearful about ChatGPT, or the metaverse, or fears about autonomous drones, about AI eroding privacy. And, you know, then you've got the sort of mother of all AI fears, the fear that AI could actually destroy humanity, the sort of existential risk of AI. So, you know, the idea that AI could actually threaten an end to the world as we know it. And, I mean, some of those claims have been advanced. You know, it's not that long ago that Elon Musk was talking in those terms. It's Stephen Hawking, the late Stephen Hawking at Cambridge, highlighted the existential risks of AI. So I think there is a lot that's rather dark and disturbing the more you look into today's high-tech culture.
I interviewed Professor Daniel Susskind for an earlier edition of The We Society, and he was kind of quite upbeat, really, saying, look, automation is going to liberate humanity in the sense that, you know, there's an infinite wants and there's going to be lots of jobs to do, and in their free time, people can find a new meaning in their lives. I mean, what's your reaction to kind of Susskind's optimism?
So I share aspects of it, but I'm not a full-blown optimist. I mean, as you know, Will, I mean, for a long time, the AI debate, or at least in its early stages, it sort of divided out between the optimists on the one side and the pessimists on the other. And that debate, whilst a kind of caricature, has taken us along so far. I think it's interesting because I think what's happened just even in the last few years, we're seeing this radical escalation and set of innovations, particularly in deep learning and machine learning. And so my take on this is that AI has been hugely, hugely successful. I mean, it's been sufficiently predictable for more and more economies to sort of enter the global digital economy. So, I mean, I think you get from the 2000s out to today, this kind of massive structure now in the world economy and the digitalization of society, where we've, you know, it's clear we're in an internet-based economy, we've got network societies and these AI-driven platforms, organizations run much of this economy. But I suppose my point is that at the same time that this is happening, at the same time you've got this growing digitalization of the world economy, you also get the beginnings of these global algorithmic system problems, yeah, where we get these sort of severe digital pathologies, such as novel forms of algorithmic bias. So I suppose I'm saying there's a sort of series of consequences here.
Anthony, what's the... Give us an example of algorithmic bias that really worries you.
Well, there's been no end to the algorithmic bias. I mean, we've seen this obviously, you know, well reported in terms of court cases of parole decisions in the United States, where courts have been increasingly reliant on AI-generated predictions to make calculations about whether prisoners are deserving of parole or not. And, there's been a huge amount of racial bias built into these predictions and with the results that have highlighted the inequities. So you sort of get a compound of, various forms of racism, for example, are kind of baked into certain algorithms, and then that gets intensified. It's not just that it's being reproduced, but it's sort of being shifted up a gear. And, I mean, similarly, there are lots of examples in terms of public institutions also. The impacts here of algorithmic decision-making run amok are obviously, you know, really serious, and I don't think we know enough about that.
One of the reasons for the kind of founding of OpenAI, which is going now for kind of some years, with lots of ups and downs about its governance, lots of worries about whether actually what it was founded to do and to kind of make sure that AI worked for the benefit of humanity is actually going to happen. But when it produced ChatGPT, I mean, 30,000 tech professionals signed a letter urging that AI was paused for at least 6 months due to the risk to humanity. Nothing happened. Was a pause necessary? And is it even more important now?
One thing to say there is the signatories to that that demand for the pause, it was a really striking letter. And I mean, I think it set out very cogently the point that we're facing a world of which there's no historical precedent. I mean, we've never lived in this kind of just-in-time digital kind of environment where our online life is increasingly starting to swamp aspects of our offline life. And particularly against the backdrop of what's been happening with advances in machine learning, I think many of those engineers and computational scientists and other esteemed professionals that put their name to the letter, it was a very important demand. But at the same time, against the backdrop of the AI race, who's going to actually sort of, be the first to say, okay, so we'll put a pause on this? I mean, you couldn't really easily see that play out, even though there was such a demand. I mean, the only place where we're really seeing, I suppose, forms of the development of regulation and governance is very much from the EU. And we all know that the EU's been pushing ahead with now trying to regulate AI. And there's lots of worries coming out from not only a lot of the big companies, but I think many others are also saying that, yes, we need regulation, but I mean, there's a danger here that it's going to be at the expense of innovation. And it's hard to see, I suppose, with the election of the Trump administration now in the United States, that at least on that side of the Atlantic, that there's going to be much interest in those sort of suggestions for a pause.
If you like this podcast, you might want to listen to Know Your Place, What Happened to Class in British Politics, a podcast series from The Conversation documentaries. The relationship between class and voting used to be clear-cut in the UK. Labour for the working class, the Conservatives for the middle class. But not anymore. And Laura Hood, senior politics editor at The Conversation, has spoken to politics experts across the country to find out why the political class divide has collapsed. All episodes available now. Listen now to Know Your Place on The Conversation documentaries, wherever you get your podcasts. I like to argue that we're in a kind of about a third of the way into what I think is going to be a 50-year transition from the kind of analog world to the digital world. I mean, it's, we've got, but already the contours of this new universe is coming into shape, and you've been discussing it. And we did think when the internet was launched, I mean, it was going to be greater share information, wisdom of the crowd, a kind of a utopia of kind of access to information, instead of which we find Wild West. And I mean, don't you kind of, of course the EU as it tries to, I mean, in their book Power and Progress, the two Nobel Prize winners, kind of Acemoglu and his Johnson, they argue that, I think only Acemoglu won the Nobel Prize, that this has been the story of technological progress since whenever, that, it could be the water mill, it could be the printing press, it could be the computer, it could be mass transport with railways. There's always been these transformative technologies, and then there's a fight that follows in which society has to say, hold on a minute, we've got to make sure that the benefits of this work for humanity, don't just enrich a few or menace a few. And of course, the regulators made mistakes when they tried to respond to that demand. But isn't it better for the European Union to make an effort to regulate, even if there are mistakes along the way, than just to say, let's have a free-for-all?
Regulation and governance are absolutely critical in this domain. I suppose the question arises is because of the nature of these extensive and intensive shifts that are happening in society because of artificial intelligence, is whether the regulatory frameworks that are being applied here can in any way measure up to the challenges that we face. So by that, Will, I simply mean that do we not run the risk of a kind of tick box ethics being developed here? And it's a bit like the General Data Protection Regulation. Every time I'm in Europe and I see people sitting on trains trying to access, download an app, you see that finger swiping on the screen as you madly try to push down to the bottom of all the text coming at you in order to accept and to take the app. Now, we know that no one can read all that. No one could possibly process it or understand it all. And do we not run a similar sort of risk there? And I suppose that's the problem. I think that AI is such a game changer that the sort of inherited world that we have of traditional ethics may not adequately be able to fit and cope with this brave new world.
What's the best idea or ideas in the plural that you've come across to address all this?
The former president of the European Research Council, Helga Novotny, in her book, In AI We Trust, which I think is a really significant book, makes the point that algorithms can make things, it can make happen what it predicts, but only when people actually follow its predictions. So I suppose what she's trying to highlight is that there are, that algorithms sort of generate these self-fulfilling prophecies. Now, we know that Silicon Valley is constantly feeding us the line that algorithms now know us better than we know ourselves. And to the extent that we imbibe that, to the extent that we swallow that, and that we reproduce these self-fulfilling prophecies. So one of the most powerful ideas, I think, here is taking note of the notion that we ultimately risk being turned into predictive systems ourselves if we approach all of this uncritically. So in terms of what that might mean for rethinking ethics, I think it's partly about the sort of conversations we're having. How do we keep the benefits of artificial intelligence? How do we hold on to what's truly transformative in a positive sense about the digital revolution, whilst actually being able to say, okay, we need to also reforge all these digital calculations, but recognize we need to be having them as have conversations alongside them. That is, we need to shift away from the metrics and keep a focus on mutuality, which is surely an important point for the we society.
Just lastly, before we wind this up, it's been a fascinating conversation, by the way, Anthony. I mean, really illuminating. We haven't talked much about democracy and about the way that algorithms kind of shape public debate, voting patterns. I'd be interested, you know, your observations about that.
I thought one of the really interesting things about this election that we've just witnessed in the United States was, against the backdrop of much of the debate and discussion of 2016, where there was obviously a huge amount of controversy around Cambridge Analytica, around the intrusion of Russian bots on Facebook. There was a great deal of consternation and alarm there, whereas, and I think a lot of people thought that was going to intensify and become much more radicalized in these last two American elections, whereas in fact 2016 seems to have been a sort of real center point for this. So that's interesting, I think. I don't know what it ultimately points to, whether things are leveling out or not. But there seemed to be less alarm about this, and less, of course. I mean, one of the problems which we haven't had a chance to talk about is that so much about algorithms is, of course, the invisibility of it all. You know, we don't actually clap eyes on it. You know, so from that angle, it's a bit like God or globalization. You know, you feel its effects, but we don't actually see it directly. So it's always a sort of retrospective thing where we're interpreting it and reinterpreting it later. So I think you know, the pundits are going to have an interesting time in terms of looking at developments in democracy. But I mean, at the same time, we know that it's an easy relationship between digitalization on the one hand and democracy on the other.
This time round in 2024, certainly, it was the kind of customizing ads for particular kind of audiences through social media, knowing what their likes and preferences were. You were able to kind of micro-advertise. And if you had the money and the smartness, you could do that. And we saw that to an extent in the British general election as well. So your point about us becoming algorithmically and invisibly driven is particularly well made in democratic elections, because invisibly we're being directed towards certain views of certain political parties by very smart algorithmic AI-driven advertising.
For sure. And I suppose because we're talking about a double-edged phenomenon, of course, AI can and is being used to contest forms of disinformation and misinformation. So we know that there are a number of certainly quite established research centers and policy institutes that are using artificial intelligence to monitor and to trace many of these instances of systematic algorithmic bias and distortion, and to highlight that work, as well as to trying to find ways to use the breakthroughs and innovations in artificial intelligence to counter those very trends.
Anthony, we're going to finish, and I'm going to give you a final two or three sentences, because you've been, you obviously, you know this stuff inside out. I think people are going to hear what you say and take it very seriously, but they also want to hear what you, Anthony Elliott, Professor Anthony Elliott, would do if you had the influence, not just in Australia, but actually internationally. What would you do?
Starting from against a societal backdrop of the rise of AI, and particularly a world now where algorithms promise services and products and lifestyles built upon mathematical exactitude, my worry remains that much of this is, we've noted the opportunities and the promises, I'm also highlighting that much of this can lead us to become prone to falling for the promises of predictive analytics. So my worry here is that, in a sense, what happens if people become increasingly seduced by the vocabulary of big tech? Yeah. So in terms of confronting that, I want to see more public conversation. So, you know, your podcast, what the Academy's doing in this respect, I think is hugely, hugely important. We can't underestimate the role of the social sciences, the humanities, and the creative arts in actually trying to highlight the massive implications of what's at stake in all of this. So I think we need more of these sorts of conversations. We need to find ways to have these conversations, certainly with policymakers, with government, and of course with industry itself. So I suppose a lot of my effort and a lot of my thinking is going into trying to, as it were, engineer ways in which that can happen, and to try and find ways in which we can highlight what these concerns are, even as a lot of them are inarticulate, or that people are struggling to make sense out of why it is that they're feeling that they're becoming disengaged or disenfranchised, or just generally, even at times, depressed by a world of constant information overload, where no matter how fast you try and run, there's that nagging sense that you can't possibly run fast enough.
Well, as President of the Academy of Social Science, we shall do our very level best to raise the salience of what you've been talking about. Anthony Elliott, thank you very much indeed for a really superb overview of the threats of artificial intelligence. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks very much.
Thank you so much for listening. The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences, who can be found at acss.org.uk. I'm Will Hutton, the producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistledown production. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast, leave a comment, share with your colleagues and friends. Thank you so much for listening.